Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Well, welcome to the Talky Bit. We're going to jump right in. My initial thought was that we could either start today with a review of parts one or two, or we could get this whole thing done today. But not both. And I would say you choose, but you weren't around when I had to choose. And so what I'm going to do is make the wee compromise of a very condensed recap and then race to the finish. So here we go. So the oldest ideas, as we've talked about them, the oldest ideas that we have about hell are those of from the Sumerians of a morally non-differentiated space where we go after we die, a next. And that idea historically evolves into this notion of two places. For the Sumerians, it was one for the good folks, one for the bad folks. And that further evolves into those two spaces being the location of two different experiences. That's not where that starts. There's still a morally undifferentiated, or they're morally differentiated, but they're still not, this is not about suffering. But then that idea comes along. So now the bad people are in a place where they're punished and the good people are in a place where they're rewarded. And I'm not going to attribute these ideas at this point, but we kind of broke that all down over the last couple of weeks. And initially in that evolution of ideas, this reward or punishment only lasted for a while, 1,000 years, but only, you know, it was time limited. But eventually it came to be believed, thanks Augustine, that it lasted forever. Anyone who was here remember Augustine's logic for this? Why did the punishment last forever? It's a beauty. It's because the guilt lasted forever. Yeah, that was the underpinning. So then perhaps over time we decided that there was something about that guilty or not guilty as a binary that rubbed the wrong way. I mean, come on, in what world is saying that I pretend to have a toothache so I don't have to go to school the moral equivalent of murdering someone? But that's where you get with a binary around this. And so we started to add some nuance to the suffering, which brings us to Dante. Zoom, zoom. So there you go. So why didn't I do that over the last 2 weeks, you may ask? Anyway, you go ahead and ask. So we left off last time with this defining line from Dante's Inferno, which of course is a huge poem that's in the middle of a yet bigger theater piece from Inferno. And the line says, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. And it's for the word nerds among us. Just a quick pause here. The more common translation of the line is, abandon hope, all ye who enter here, as distinct from abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Translators are constantly making these kind of decisions. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here, means something different than abandon all hope, ye who enter here, but it reads better in translation. So that's the one that's gotten traction, but it's the other one's closer to the original language. And then in the Divine Comedy, the context for this poem, Dante gets even more explicit, and he maps these nine circles of hell with specific punishments for each sin. And essentially what he's doing is he's providing a dramatization of medieval theology and moral order. And the upshot of that is, go see the play, learn how the world works. That's sort of what's going on in terms of the art making. If you've ever had a conversation with someone about what they believe and you recognize in what they're saying the plot of a movie that you've seen, you're experiencing one version of how this works for us as humans, right? Like we're story makers, and when our imagination is captured by something in ways that answer a deep existential question for us, we tend to grab onto that story, and we hold onto it with a lot of tenacity. Don't want to get into the weeds on this, but But the stories that we hold unconsciously have a unique power in this regard. The ones that we don't know why they're in there, but they're in there, and they guide us. So Jung, of course, famously built a entire way of looking at the psyche on this. I did say I was going to get into Dante in more detail, and I want to keep my word because lying is bad. And if hell is either or, So I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it in a limited way. So right there, okay, that's moral complexity right there, just if you needed an example. So quick tour of Dante's key ideas. Listen, in this section, I would say listen for ideas that still give shape to our contemporary ideas and practices around morality and justice in particular, all right, because that's a big part of the structure here. So sort of seven key points, because what a lovely number. So for Dante, hell is a structured realm of divine justice. It's organized into 9 concentric circles. Each circle represents a different sin. The deeper the circle, the more severe the sin and the more severe the punishment. So this system reflects this idea of what would in the original language been contrapasso or counter-suffering, where the punishment fits the sin. And in Dante, and this shows up again in more contemporary forms, we'll get to that, often through poetic or ironic justice. You killed the weatherman because you didn't like the bad forecast and you went to hell and you ended up in the room where it rains all the time. That kind of thing, right? And this idea of ironic justice shows up again in The Good Place, the TV series, which we will we'll consider toward the end of our time together, briefly. Second piece for Dante is that sins are categorized in hell. They're categorized both morally and philosophically. He's drawing on Aristotle and Christian theology. When he does this, he divides sins into sort of 3 major types. There are sins of what translates in Dante's language into the word, our English word, incontinence, what he would call sins of lack of self-control, and that's sort of circles 2 through 5. Everything gets us into circle 1. But in circles 2 through 5, we've got sins like lust, gluttony, greed, wrath. And then circle 7 is sort of all on its own, and that's violence. Those are sins of violence, and that can be violence against others, against the self, against God, or against nature. I was reading through this list, and I was thinking, where does capitalism fit in here? Anyway, the last circle is fraud, circles 8 and 9, and deception to Dante is seen as the worst offense because it's the worst offense to human reason and trust. So to behave fraudulently is to violate trust, and to him, that's as bad as it gets. And so the hierarchy implies that sins involving deliberate deception are more grievous than sins of weakness. And that's an idea that guides a lot of our justice system to this day. That's why we have degrees of murder. Crime of passion. I saw red and I punched a guy. I didn't mean to kill him is different than I planned this for months and laid in wait. And so that's still, that's Dante, worked out in the justice system. The third piece for Dante is this notion that hell is eternal and it's irrevocable. There is no redemption from Dante's perspective for souls in hell. The damned are fully aware of their fate. They are trapped in the consequences of their choices. And their state reflects this medieval belief that one's eternal fate is sealed at death. That's still present in lots of theologies, hence last rites and so on and so forth. Interestingly, in terms of Christian theology, the Eastern Orthodox Christian theological framework does not believe this. You can keep working your way out even after you die. How lovely. It's almost enough to make me, jump ship, become Orthodox. Fourth piece here is there's a really significant role in Dante's understanding of hell for reason and order, and in particular divine order, because Dante presents his picture of hell as a divinely ordered universe. Everything in there reflects the order of the divine, and so even the horrors of Dante's hell reflect God's justice. Right? There's not another source here. This is all about the divine. And on the reason side, the architecture of hell is highly rational. It's very philosophical. It's designed with precision. And for Dante, this reflects the fact that he was working with the scholastic ideals, philosophical ideas, which we won't get into, but that's where it's so important to him that this has order, and you can tell when you shift from one circle to another. Also a piece here that's about symbolism and allegory. So for Dante, hell is a physical place, but it's not just a physical place. It's also an allegory for spiritual states and for moral truths. And this is quite particular about this. Every punishment, every character, every setting is symbolic of a deeper theological or ethical idea. Like there's always something going on underneath the stuff that's on the surface. And he often includes historic and contemporary figures in his illustrations to make moral critiques, contemporary moral critiques as well as historic ones. Which brings us to sort of the sixth piece of Dante's sort of structure, which is political and personal commentary. So he uses hell, when he's writing about it, to critique political corruption and religious hypocrisy, as well as personal enemies, you know, the neighbor he doesn't like. There are figures in Dante's work that are in hell that would have been immediately recognizable to his contemporaries in Florence, where he and some of them lived. And it sort of gives Inferno this dual nature. It's theological and it's political. So there's really sort of nothing new under the sun, is there? Like, this intersection of religion and art and religion and politics is, you know, about as old as religion and politics. And then there's two guides in Dante's journey through hell. One of them is the first one. So we get sort of started in finding our way through hell with reason. And that's the Roman poet Virgil, who's the guide, the rational guide through hell. So we can figure out how to find our way through it, or ideally keep ourselves out of it with reason. But then as he goes along and he kind of leaves the poem and goes into the Divine Comedy, he moves beyond reason. And this is a fascinating movement to me, just broadly speaking. He moves beyond reason to divine love. It's represented by the Beatrice character in the play. So the guide changes. There is a superior guide, I would argue, in this. But, you know, millions would disagree. But I feel like he's, I don't feel like that's a random movement for Dante. So that's the big picture, if you want, in medieval terms, as outlined by Dante. And now things start to get a little more nuanced. Along comes Thomas Aquinas. So now we're in the early to late 1200 CE, 1225 to 74. Aquinas writes a lot of theology. There's lots of output. But on the matter of hell, one of his key ideas was that there are two categories of punishment. Time for some Latin, folks. So he had these two categories, poena damni, which is punishment that is about the loss of God's presence. And so he introduces a couple of really important ideas here that keep going over time. And poena sensus, which is physical torment. So there's two different kinds of punishment in Aquinas' work. And when he's building on that in Summa Theologica, he writes this. In order that the happiness of the saints may be more delightful to them, they are allowed to see the sufferings of the damned in hell. Now, yes, exactly. So we do need to pause here. Okay. Let's consider the implications of this over time a little. So we now have, in the evolution of the sort of Western mind about hell, we have a moral universe in which we are not only sorting all the humans into two bins, heaven for the morally good and hell for the morally bad, but we're also illustrating the idea that this is the cosmic order. This is the way the moral universe works. So divine justice looks not only like the bad being eternally punished and the good being eternally rewarded, but it also features God setting things up, pay attention, all right? So the good people get to look down on and laugh at the bad people for the pleasure of the good people. Right. So, have you ever, don't answer this, but have you ever felt judged by someone? And how did that feel? And was that judgment ever accompanied by something like disdain or mockery? Or laughter? And if it was, how did that feel? And how would it, or did it, feel if you were confronted that behavior and the justification for it you got back was something like, that's the way it should be because I'm living my life God's way and you're not? Because that's this. From where I sit, that's a story shape that goes a long way toward explaining a lot of bad behavior, including many things that we think of as isms, sort of broad swaths of human behavior that generally don't make the world a better place for everyone to live in. Because really, if I believe I'm doing what God says should be done and you're not, me laughing at you in this moral framework is not only justified, but it's me behaving like God does. I'm imitating the divine when I do that. And that's just ugly. Which brings us to some aspects of, pop culture in the 12th to 15th centuries. How's that for a broad swath? We might have invented or think we invented doom scrolling, but it was religion in those centuries that specialized in a whole category of art called doom paintings. These are special. Along with these being very common, morality plays were also common. And the culture generally was fairly thick with vivid and direct warnings of hell. There's a rather large painting. This is an intact work in place in the St. Thomas Church in Salisbury. It's
So you can see the sort of contemporary church, but this is you can't get into the church without walking through this one. There's an inscription that doesn't show here, but
below it that says,
it says this, "Behold, all ye who pass by, what awaits you if you stray?" And this is, you know, what awaits you.
Right? So just try to imagine the table for a moment, if you will, with, you know, over the door. That's what we're talking about structurally, okay? And so it's just worth remembering that this is the way these things were conveyed into the moral imagination of the populace at the time. And lots of those ideas, historically speaking, land and they stick. And they track forward into the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. So, you know, the great reformers, Luther and Calvin. Martin Luther, in a letter to a colleague, affirms the literal existence of hell, but warns against, quote, selling indulgences to avoid hell. And for those not familiar, I didn't grow up around selling indulgences, but, you know, studied it. The short version of selling indulgences is that you could basically, very short version, make a donation to the church and basically buy your way out of hell in advance. It sort of falls under book early to avoid disappointment. But practically speaking, put a new roof on the cathedral and have all the mistresses you want. It'll be fine. In Luther's words from that letter, "I would not have anyone secure in their sins through false confidence. Hell is real and terrible." And so he's basically like, indulgence is, you know, not going to cut it. Calvin, the other great reformer, emphasized that hell was divine justice. It was not arbitrary wrath. So what's nothing random about this, which in some ways is, I would say, as an idea, more alarming rather than less. But in the Institutes of Christian Religion, he writes what you see here. He writes, "By such vengeance, hell, God vindicates his glory, which the wicked have profaned." So it's justified. You don't have to leave town to find churches where this is still the perspective that's held and that's preached. This idea has had lots of stickiness to it. All right, so onward into the Enlightenment, which I will deal with in half a page. 17th and 18th centuries. So the Enlightenment, for those of us who could use a little history tune-up and who couldn't, philosophical intellectual movement, it emphasized reason, individualism, and scientific inquiry, and it challenged traditional authority and promoted a more secular view of the world. Does that sound familiar? That's rather contemporary, isn't it? Well, long echo in this part of the world from the Enlightenment. Lots of those ideals are still very much in play. With those sorts of themes, you can probably imagine that some of the key thinkers in the Enlightenment might have taken a pretty good swipe at the primary ideas from the medieval period, right? It's characteristic of the period, but also, man, there's just lots there to swipe at. Voltaire, who's a towering figure in the period, he certainly does. He just outright mocks the doctrine of eternal torment. Philosophical Dictionary, his work, 1764, in a section succinctly titled Hell, he asks this rhetorical question: is it any less absurd to damn a soul forever for a few moments of error? In other words, it seems out of whack, even considering that Dante would say that a few minutes of error only lands you in layer one of hell, forever, mind you, unless your error was fraud, in which case you go right to the bottom. Right, but even with that in view, it does seem like, even with the layers, no, this isn't quite settling during a period where these things are being challenged. David Hume, also a significant figure in the period as regards theology and in his dialogues concerning natural religion, so in our late 1700s, points out that hell is incompatible with divine goodness. So these ideas are starting to rub a little bit. So that's a theme, this idea that hell is incompatible with divine goodness, generally speaking. That's a theme we'll see crop up again shortly. So in the 19th and 20th centuries, we get a couple of larger theological movements that suggest that some adjustments are desirable, they're needed. Hosea Ballou, so late 1800s, important thinker in what is often called the Universalism Revival, notes that, in his words, God's punishment is corrective, not vindictive. Eternal hell is inconsistent with his nature. Well, this makes sense in context. And by context, I mean universalism, because universalism essentially contends that God, who is love, saves everyone. And in that story framework, we still need saving. So that's the brokenness that Augustine sort of really championed is still there. We still deserve to be punished, but God's not made that way. He loves us, so he wants to save us. It's in his nature to do so. I find it fascinating how people are willing to say with such confidence, this is the nature of the divine. not least of all because by this point in history, there is plenty of knowledge that the divine has been conceived in many different ways by many different people groups, many different thinkers, even just within, and that's where I'm sort of staying, is within the lane of the thought life of a particular hemisphere, a particular stream of thought, different and wildly different from this in other parts of the world. It does bring a question to mind for me, which is, how much power do you have to wield in the world to remain convinced that your way is right and everyone else's way is wrong? Quite a lot, I suspect. Another interesting movement from this period is called annihilationism. So now we're into the early 80s. And yes, that movement is about as terminal as it sounds. Key figure in that movement is a thinker named Edward Fudge, who wrote a whole book called The Fire That Consumes, in which he states, "The wicked will be burned up, not burned forever," which, in a maneuver that at least to me feels pretty obvious, harkens back to the Egyptian idea that souls that aren't light enough get eaten by Ammit. That's a very similarly shaped idea. So we still got good and bad, we still got the two bins, but in the bad bin, you go poof. This is the same time frame where we have the well-known writings, at least in the context where my ideas were impacted, of C.S. Lewis, who addresses hell in a couple of different books. In The Problem of Pain, which I remember reading, I think I could probably take you to where I was when I read that book. That was one of those, that was an aha book for me in lots of ways. But in that book, Lewis portrays hell as self-chosen isolation rather than imposed punishment. And he states that, quote, "the gates of hell are locked on the inside." I mean, one of the reasons we're still reading C.S. Lewis, if we're still reading C.S. Lewis, is because he does things like that with words, right? And just kind of like, there's the picture right there. In other words, it's a choice. And if we don't consciously choose it, from Lewis's perspective, we don't end up there. So we have to choose in. A trope, of course, among other things. See you in hell, gleefully. You know, that whole idea, right? I can remember some of my zealous evangelical friends kind of freaking out about this and concluding that Lewis must be one of those horribly dangerous universalists. And I remember thinking then, as I think now, what a terrible thought that God would save everyone. Sarcasm. Where's the justice in that? I mean, that idea implies that even someone that wronged me is going to get saved rather than be punished. And maybe that's why it's not okay, because they should get theirs. I think it only takes one step back from that idea to realize that it only works if you're convinced you're on the winning side. And if you take two steps back, you might find yourself thinking back to Augustine and the doctrine of original sin and wondering if maybe that idea is the problem. All right, that's a lot. Alrighty, let's wrap this up with a quick look around our contemporary neighborhood. Recently deceased Pope Francis is reported to have said, and this is a contested attribution, but he's reported to have said in a 2018 interview, "Hell is not a place, it's a state of being distant from God." So now we're into contemporary thoughts about hell from contemporary Christian theologians of note, including the Pope. Rob Bell, in his 2011 book, Love Wins, asks this question: will all people be saved, or will God keep endless conscious torment going forever? Love demands we ask that question. Bell, of course, as the title suggests, concludes that love does, in fact, win. I personally know quite well religious leaders who told their congregants to stay away from this book because its ideas were hazardous. It seems that not everyone thinks evolving these ideas is a good idea. What's a threat here? Anyway, it's bad for business. In popular media, we can find lots of examples of this evolution, but one high-profile example is, of course, the show The Good Place, in which these questions were not subtext, but they were the main material. I remember when I started watching this, and I'm usually a late arriver to these things. I would like to say that that's about time and priorities and be really self-aggrandizing, but it's more just like, I just don't spend very much time doing it. It's a choice. But when I did start watching this, I was like, oh, this is really funny. And then a couple of episodes in, I kind of started to make this shift to, oh, this is really smart. And that's sort of where I stayed in terms of my experience with it. We could really dig into this, obviously. That could be an entire thing on its own. But again, I'm going to just sort of do the short version. In The Good Place, so a very contemporary critique of traditional notions of hell, we've got this idea that hell is psychological and not just physical. So unlike traditional depictions that involve sort of fire and brimstone and boiling pots of oil and demons eating you endlessly for lunch and so on, The Bad Place inflicts suffering primarily through emotional and psychological torment. Characters are tortured in ways that target their specific insecurities, their fears, their regrets. Remember Dante and irony, all right? This is a big feature. So this basically reflects a modern reinterpretation of hell as self-inflicted, C.S. Lewis, locked on the inside, and tailored to one's moral failings, Dante again. Second big feature here is moral complexity in the points system. How many of you have watched The Good Place? Or some? Yeah, a couple times, yeah. I mean, when they start to get into this, the point system thing, which is a big chunk of the critique, it's hilarious, but also there's a lot of insight going on here. So in The Bad Place, within The Good Place, people are sent to The Bad Place based on sort of a cosmic points system where every action is assigned a value, Dante. But it's revealed in the course of the show that no one has gotten into The Good Place for centuries because modern life makes it impossible to act with pure motives or outcomes. And the critique that we find there shows that hell is a result of broken, overly simplistic system of moral judgment rather than inherent evil. That the problem here is actually systemic, not moral. We've got a broken system. So that shows up there as well. Third feature in this series was the idea that people can change. So again, not a new idea, present in, you know, old Christianity, just not on this side of the ocean. But the series ultimately argues that eternal damnation. When people in the afterlife in the series are given a chance to learn and grow and reflect, they improve. They get better. And there is a sharp critique in the show of the traditional notion of hell as permanent punishment. And basically, if you wanted to kind of sum it up, the show proposes a rehabilitative rather than a punitive model for judgment. So it's not that there's no price to pay. This is not a universe without morals. But the intent of the price is that it's rehabilitative. It's just a different lens, isn't it? The series also suggests that real hell is disconnection and lack of growth. If you want to know what the human experience of hell is, that's it. The core torment of The Bad Place tends to revolve around things like isolation and repetition and the inability to change or connect. I keep thinking about the way repetition shows up. It's like, has anybody here ever thought about the traditional notion of heaven and gone, how do we deal with boredom in this picture? That's basically that same problem showing up. And of course, the inability to change or connect. That's why we use a phrase perhaps in English like the hell of lockdown, don't we? So the show suggests that in fact stagnation, ignorance, and loneliness are the real forms of damnation. Boiling oil? Bah. Try being alone. And then in what I think is really one of the funniest bits, although it tends to be presented fairly low-key for the most part, is this notion that hell is a bureaucratic failure. Which I don't know. That idea just really makes me laugh. It's very British, among other things, in a lot of ways. Anyway, in the show, the afterlife systems are depicted as absurdly complex and outdated, both. And they're run by unfeeling demons and clueless administrators, like people who are just like, this is how we do it around here. And that's how, right? And there's a critique in there, among other things, or satirizing of how moral or religious institutions can become ineffective or unjust over time, leading to suffering, not out of malice, but inefficiency, out of lack of internal critique and improvement. Which, of course, is represented in, again, a trope, but a one that shows up in meaningful ways in all sorts of collectives. That's the way we do things around here. Ask a question, that's the answer you get. That's how it's done. That's what this is taking a poke at. And then finally, the idea that shows up in the show is this idea that redemption requires two things. It requires choice and it requires time. And in the end, of course, the show ultimately replaces the bad place with a system where souls can work toward betterment over time with support. So we still have the notion of an eternal soul here, but the soul, the person, the being, gets to continue to work at getting better. When you physically die, that's not the end of your moral story. And that reflects the idea of hell as, or rejects the idea of hell as a final destination, and it instead promotes the ideas of ethical growth and second chances. And second chances is a failure of language, ongoing chances. So, some final thoughts in this context. The overall movement through history, I think it's fair to say, around ideas about hell is generally one that tracks away from external punishment and towards internal alienation. If we think of God as external to us, that works. If we think, either individually or collectively, that we constitute the divine, that still works. Either way, the problem is alienation. So if the self is divine and we're alienated from the self, we're still alienated. If the divine is external and we're alienated from an external divine, we're alienated. If we want to get sort of a more immersive experience of contemporary thought about all of this, we could do much worse than watching The Good Place, which, as I said, is a wickedly smart critique of many of those same ideas and just way more entertaining than I am. Or, if we don't want to invest all that time, because, you know, yard work is calling, or we're dealing with aging parents, or work, or the rest of life, we could skip the series, and we could conclude with contemporary theologian Paul Tillich that, quote, hell is the absence of the being of God. Now, just a quick little nuance here, and this is really important in Tillich's work. He did not say hell is the absence of a being called God. Just no God. It's the absence, hell is the absence of whatever we understand or experience as creator, mystery, divine, the kinds of aspects of our lived experience for which we would use God language and God stories. So for Tillich, that's hell. If we didn't have those stories, whatever the opposite of that is, whatever shape that takes, that is to be tormented as a human being, is to not have some story that helps us with those existential questions. And I decided to leave it there because I think leaving it there leaves us with a lot to explore. And since that's, you know, what we're here to do, I thought that was probably a good place to stop, do some thinking of our own, maybe have some conversations with others as we continue to explore what we believe. I'm going to leave us with one final, very brief contemporary thought from, I've quoted this person before, they're a photographer, friend of mine, a brilliant photographer, but also a brilliant teacher, a very philosophical teacher of making images. And he wrote a blog this past week about how there's this, inside the photography world, there's always this kind of, real photographers never do this. If you're a real photographer, you'd never switch it to program. Whatever, you know. And he kind of goes through a list of all these tropes, right, in the blog. But then at the end, he says, there is a point. Because he's starting to wonder, what's his point? Fake? Is there a point to this kind of thinking? I need a drink, quote. And then he says, well, there is a point. And it's that some people can only feel as though they are special by putting others down. And I thought that pulled a lot of the threads of our conversation about hell together. A lot of this is about identity. It's about me versus you. It's about my story versus your story. And I think the more we realize how interconnected we are and interdependent we actually are as a species, the more we will find that distinguishing me against you work unsatisfying. Differentiation is one thing. Competition is another. And I thought that David kind of nailed it. He goes on to say, they can only feel in by forcing others out. And then the philosopher shows up, quote, after all, if we're all special, then no one is special, bracket, also nonsense, but that's not what this is about, close bracket. Right? So there's lots there to explore. I leave that with you. I will continue to do the same. I hope that we can continue to do it together and that we can continue to do it in a way that has somewhere in the mix of the way it feels to do that sort of work, something that we would name peace. Peace.